So that's a cool thing about this correspondence. And it was based on a string theory framework, like Noel Sena found it through string theory, but it's important to know that it like stands on its own, so you can like derive it separately. All right, so it now is in the limit of the ADCP course. Oh, wait. Sorry. First, I want to give you guys a graphic picture of it. So we have the antipositive state in the bulk, in the interior here, and they have this conformal boundary, and then the ADS-CFT correspondence links the boundary stress tensor of this conformal boundary to a bulk metric of the inside. All right, so if you now take a limit of this correspondence, the long wavelength limit, you get the fluid guarantee correspondence. And this links the p plus 1 dimensional solution to Einstein equations to the d dimensional relative state hydrodynamic bulk equations. So basically, if you take the long wavelength limit, you can look at isotropy antipositive black holes and link those to relative state fluids. This is because this boundary stress tensor goes into this long wavelength limit, gives a fluid form, like a relative state fluid form. And so because of this correspondence, you can like look at fluids and phenomena in relative fluids and then link that to gravity. So that's pretty cool. So what we now want to do is we want to study the fluid first, like we want to understand everything about relative hydrodynamics to learn more about gravity. So we all know that like hydrodynamics is most important equation is the Navier-Stokes equation, which is given over here. But this equation describes non-relativistic fluid flows, incompressible fluid flows. But if you look at the fluid gravity correspondence, we want to look at the relativistic case. And unfortunately, there's not much known about that yet. So, well, unfortunately, actually, it's quite good because it's an open field, basically. So, if you look at the relativistic case, you get this stress energy tensor, and the covariant derivative of the stress energy tensor has to be equal to zero. And if you then look at like the ideal fluid equation with pressure and density and the velocity of the fluid, you can get an expression for the stress energy tensor. And we can also impose that the stress energy tensor has to be traceless because it has to be formed variant. And so this is the ideal case. So if it's not ideal, then you will get like an additional viscous term here for stress energy tensor. Then this way you can evaluate relativistic fluids. And then it's also important to know that there will be a difference between fluid flows in two space and dimensions and fluid flows in three space and dimensions. But we will come back to this later, so then we'll talk about it more detail. Then it's also important to know that there are two different kinds of flows. So you can have laminar flow, which is really like smooth, stable flows, which can easily be analyzed analytically. But then you also have turbulent flows, which are really chaotic, it's nonlinear, it's really difficult to model. The problem is that turbulent flows are most common in nature, so actually the one which is most difficult to model is what you usually encounter in nature. So we want to look more at these turbulent flows. And also, if we look at the gravity correspondence, then we know that this laminar flow will correspond to quasi-normal modes in gravity. So in gravity, we usually apply linear approximations to black holes. And then you obtain these quasi-normal modes. Basically, it's like you have a normal mode, and then it slowly decays in energy. And this is because the black hole kind of absorbs this energy. And this is, this is a well-known correspondence between the laminar flow and this linear approximation of black holes. But then for turbulent flow, we didn't really have that yet a couple years ago. So it basically would correspond to a new phase in gravity because of fluid gravity correspondence, you know that must correspond to something. So we want to look more at this turbulence phenomenon. So this phenomenon occurs for high Reynolds numbers. So the Reynolds number is basically just a number they use in hydrodynamics to indicate what kind of flow you have. So if this r, which is given by velocity times the Planck scale of the system, divided by the viscosity, if this is small, so much smaller than one, then it will be a laminar flow, so it's really smooth. And if it's high, then you get a turbulence. And so it often is high because viscosity is usually quite small in nature. So that's why we usually get turbulent phenomena in nature instead of laminar ones. And of course, you have an in-between regime, which is kind of like chaotic regime, but crystal, we will now only look at the turbulence, so for really large Reynolds numbers. And so there's nonlinear interactions and it's a totally chaotic behavior, so it's really difficult to model. So another important thing which makes it difficult to model turbulent small mass is the fact that you get a kind of energy cascade. This means that energy will either vastly increase or decrease with the wavelength. And this is dependent on the situation, but I will come back to this later, but it means that it makes it extra difficult to model because you have this additional so you have this nonlinear behavior, Pauli behavior, and then you also that the energies change in this way. Now we want to look at due to the fluid gravity correspondence, we know that there's turbulence in fluids. Does it mean then that the gravitational fields can also go turbulent? So this is the motivation for this research. So to sort of recap what we said before, so from the ADS we know that the boundary stress energy transfer is linked to the Bolt metric. Then we know from the fluid gravity correspondence that for long wavelengths, the boundary stress energy transfer takes the form of a relatively simple form of fluid. Since the fluids show turbulence and they're nonlinear, but the black hole perturbation is usually studied in a linear approximation, we now want to study black hole perturbation in nonlinear flows by using this fluid equations now. So this was done in a paper by Stephen Green, postdoc here at Cresco, and Vince Lehner in 2013. So they had this initial data as shear mode, and they were following the vorticity as a function of time. And so, here you can see the turbulent small mass occurring, and so slowly eddies are forming. And here you can see vortices forming, and then slowly decays to these two vortices at the end now. And this is because of this energy cascade which I was talking about. So the energy is vastly increasing. And then eventually you can also link the boundary quantities to the bulk metric. So they link the vorticity to principal variance little tensor here, and you can see how well they correspond. So this is really cool, but the thing is, what we'll talk about is more the hydrodynamical side. Because before we can do really cool stuff by linking the hydrodynamics to the gravity side, we first need to understand everything about relative viscous fluids. So no more pretty pictures, so now only difficult equations, not also difficult but equations. So this is what they did in this paper we've been discussing, so by the personal aesthetic. And stimulation. So back to these cascades. So for these cascades, it's important to note that there's a difference between two space and dimension and three space and dimensions already noted. Well, actually two space dimension and all other dimensions. So for DS2, you have two different kinds of cascades. So you have an inverse cascade, which means that you have energy flow towards larger wavelengths and it's associated with energy. And you have a so-called direct cascade, which is basically flow towards smaller wavelengths, and it's associated with this new quantity. It's a quantity in hydrodynamics called entropy, and it's related to the vorticity of the system. And but then for larger than two dimensions, you'll have a direct energy cascade. So instead of an inverse one for energy, you have a direct one. So it's kind of a sine swap. So this is more we'll need this for the communications. So this looks like a full slide, but I just wanted to show how this Komogorov derived the scaling equation for the energy for the two-dimensional case in 1941, so quite a long time ago. And so what he did is he looked at this cascade behavior. So he realized that you have these large eddies which are as you go to long wavelengths, the energy is increasing, and then he realized that there has to be a relation between the spectral energy and the energy flow. So he imposed this ansatz here, and then he tried to solve this for these parameters p and q, where k is just a length scale. And then just by performing dimensional analysis, he derived this scaling law for the energy in turbulent systems for two-dimensional systems. And then you can do similar things for different kind of scaling laws. So you can do this for the direct scale behavior, which was related to this entropy, if you remember. And then you also can get a relation for the energy. And then you can also do this for velocities. So then you will look at this the average of this energy between velocity evaluated at point r and at point zero times the unit vector. And so this is all very nice, and this has all been done, but this is all still for non-relativistic cases. And you can just write these relations for the Navier-Stokes equation, which is for non-relativistic cases. But now what we really want to do is look at the relativistic case. So this is where the paper really starts, basically. So this is all background. And then we can find the corresponding relativistic relation for the stress energy tensor. So this was done by Cooks and Oz in 2010. They implemented now like an external force in the equation for the stress energy tensor, and they assumed the steady state regime. And then they obtained this correlation function for the stress energy tensors evaluated at two different points. So like this prime here means that it's evaluated at a different point R2. So you have the relation between the stress energy tensor point R1 and R2, basically. The correlation between that is related to this constant, which is the energy dissipation in this case, the arc distance, and the dimension of the system.
Tiffany?
Yes.
Your equation has two eyes on the left. Are they summed over? If they are, why is it still on the right?
What here?
Yeah.
Sorry, what was the question?
The question is the inertia equation on the left.
Yeah.
Are the eyes summed over?
Yeah.
But on the right, you still have eye.
Oh yeah, I think this is a mistake actually. This should just be, it's also like a constant, so I think
it Oh, it's be, just a constant. Okay.
Yeah, it should just be. All
right.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Yeah. Actually, I saw that in a test run, but that's okay. Yeah. All right. I see my mistake. Okay. They did this. They said that this was valid in all dimensions, but basically the assumption of the steady state regime is not valid necessarily in all dimensions. And now again, the difference between the DS2 spatial dimension and the DS3 spatial dimension comes into play. Does fluid flow different for that? Because steady state condition is only valid if all energy injected by this external force term is dissipated. This is true if you have a dimension larger than 2, because then you have this direct energy cascade behavior, and because of this cascade, your injected energy will go to the viscous scale and then this phase, but this is not necessarily true for the DS2 phase. You can also see that with this relation where you have, this is the relation for the energy respect to the sigma. So if your viscosity goes to really small values, a large omega can still keep the energy dissipation going on. So then your steady state condition will still be valid. And this is true for these larger two, because then the sigma phase is worse term because of vortex stretching, which is basically just like these vortices are stretching, like elongating. But in the DS2 case, this vortex stretching does not occur anymore because the vorticity is always normal to the surface there, so you can basically not have derivatives of that, so you don't have this vortex stretching. So therefore, your sigma doesn't play source term anymore, so if you go to small viscosities, this energy dissipation is no longer valid, so your steady state condition is no longer valid. So they realized this in this paper, and then they were able to derive a new relation for two dimensions. So this D before, and also like the substrate. So this D here is now replaced by 2, but you can also see that there's a minus sign now. So you get opposite sign, which also makes sense because before I had the direct cascade range for these larger two, and now I have the inverse cascade, so it's exactly the other way around. And then you get the minus sign. And that was basically the main result they found in this paper. So to conclude, the fluid gravity correspondence allows you to compare phenomena occurring in relativistic fluid with black holes. But before we can do whatever you relate these, we need to add more information about the relativistic pattern and turbulence scale relations, because we first need to completely understand the relativistic fluid side before we can link it to the black holes. And so in future research, we will try to link these stress energy tensors for the relativistic fluids to a bulk metric. So again, really link it with fluid gravity correspondence to black holes. All right, so that's the first station. So if there are any questions,
So you said that there's still like this step from boundary fluid to the metric itself has to be taken.
Yeah.
But you already saw that in 2+1 dimensions on the fluid side, you got like these very large structures. Does it mean that in 3+1 dimensions, your chaotic gravity will give you like large scale structure formation around the black hole?
Yeah, probably, yeah. For the higher dimensions, it's like even more challenging.
Are there simulations which show that, or?
Well, they expect it anyway, yeah, but there still has to be done a lot of research on like the higher dimension side, yeah. So that's the main thing. So basically, most scaling layers have now been derived for growth discipline side, now we're gonna, for growth discipline side, and now we're gonna map it to the bulk metric, hopefully. And also
look at
high dimensions, yeah.
So some time ago there was a talk by Stephen Green where he looked at nonlinear perturbations of an ADS black hole. So what he did was he took an ADS black hole and perturbed it with I think scalar field or something like this. But because it's ADS, the perturbations that go through the black hole or onto the black hole, they bounce off, but they come back because you have periodic boundary conditions in ADS. So which actually gives you this kind of nonlinear regime of the perturbation at some point. So is that related in some sense? Because it seems to be that you only get this behavior of turbulence with a negative cosmological constant, so like with some kind of time-like boundary where you have stuff coming back again, like from infinity to infinity. So is this related to what Stephen was doing, or is it, do people look at it from different perspectives, like not in this fluid correspondence, but also like in nonlinear perturbation form?
I think they're also looking at like, for example, fastly rotating curved black holes right now, because then, because entity jitter is, to see it from another side. I think they're also doing it for now, but I don't know so much about it.
So you would have at some point, you could check if that makes sense. I mean, if you're not just taking this ADS fluid correspondence and then just find some result, but you could actually check if this other people find something similar in doing nonlinear perturbation or something like this. So there is a way to check this at some point. Because it seems always that kind of magical. I mean, this, if you can find some kind of correspondence between two things that you wouldn't expect to have a relation with each other, right? So it would be nice if there's like a third party checking something and you could just independently see if that gives you roughly the same idea.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Okay, yeah.
But I do think there have been a lot of tests, like also like what we saw in, a long way back, that you had this like fugitive plot and the other plots derived from the bulk metric, and you could see how closely they look similar. But yeah, you're right. I mean, in principle, they shouldn't be related, so it's pretty cool that they are. Right. Any more questions?
Yeah.
Hello, nice to meet you. My name is Won Jun Choi. And what is going on? Yeah. Okay. Today is March 7th, and I'm here to talk about the low energy effective theory of non-Fermi liquid. So this talk is not about conformal bootstrap, ADS CFT, quantum gravity, or super young nils, or scattering amplitude, or graviton scattering. So relax, it is almost QED level calculation, so it is not that much complicated. I hope you enjoy the talk. Then let's see what is the problem. This is the Lagrangian density, and if we can solve this problem, I mean, if we can solve this quantum field theory, then everything is done. This is the first term. Can I use the laser point? Oh, okay. This term is kinetic term. This is interaction term, and this is gauge term. Well, you cannot see the gauge structure apparently here because it is already fixed. So you cannot see the gauge symmetry here. Here, the A is transverse component of U and gauge field in Coulomb gauge. So I use the Coulomb gauge. And you can.
Sorry, why did the x and y derivatives show up in a different footing? Like you have linear and x with an I in front of it, and then dy squared.
Well, this is related to the next slide, I think.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. Okay. So this is strongly coupled non-relativistic 2 plus 1 quantum electrodynamics with one-dimensional Fermi surface. So the key part is 1D Fermi surface. Like, we know how to solve QED. Well, there is a problem of Landau pole, but that is not really practically important. So actually, we know, well, it seems like this problem is not very difficult because we know how to solve the correlation, how to calculate correlation function using Feynman diagram technique. But the problem is, usually we assume that the interaction E, this dimensionless parameter, is small compared to the kinetic term. And also when we deal with the scattering experiment, we assume that two particles are originally far away each other and they are asymptotically free in the beginning, and eventually they experience the interaction for a short amount of time and then go back to their free, like, and going back to far away each other and eventually asymptotically free again. But here, the problem is a bit different. Like, we cannot make electron inside a metal asymptotically free as we, like, we don't have that kind of freedom. Like, they are always interacting with each other and they are pretty close to each other, actually. So. We should deal with this strongly coupled problem directly. And there is basically two comments about the dimension. So it seems like this problem might be easier than the 4D QFT because dimension is low, but actually it is not. 2D is very special in a sense that in case of 1D problem, the Fermi surface is not connected. It is actually two Fermi points. So we can solve the problem using the technique so-called bosonization. And if you have ever seen the Luttinger liquid problem, like you may have seen how we can map the strongly interacting fermion problem to the non-interacting boson problem. But we cannot use that kind of trick here because in 2D, Fermi surface is 1D circle, so it is extended. And we cannot use the same technique we used in 1D problem. And 2D is special in different ways. So when the dimension is low, quantum fluctuation is enhanced. So of course, the most violent quantum fluctuation can be seen in one-dimensional system. But as I said, 1D can some way around that quantum fluctuation. But in 2D, we cannot solve quantum fluctuation problem in that way. So 2D has very strong quantum fluctuation. At the same time, we cannot use bosonization to get around because Fermi surface is extended. So let's see how this Fermi surface make problem more complicated than you may expect it. So this is 1D Fermi surface. This is Fermi vector. So I will not go too much in detail. That, like, this Fermi surface is a bit different from what you may know in Fermi gas context. Like, in case of Fermi gas, like, the reciprocal space, like kx, ky, are the good quantum numbers. So we can pack the state from the ground state. We can pack the electron from the low k to the Fermi weight vector step by step. But when the interactions are included into the Lagrangian, the kx and ky are no longer a good quantum number. So it actually, this boundary cannot be very sharp. But actually, there exists a mathematical sharp boundary. So in case of Fermi liquid theory, I hope Dennis provide very sufficient lecture about Fermi liquid in the condensed quark courses. And like I'm not sure, but we maybe have seen that there is some singular point. So I'm not sure whether you can see the board, but
no.
Yeah, okay. Would you please turn on the light? So this is the energy, and this is the occupation number of the state. And if this is a Fermi energy, in case of Fermi gas, here's one. And I keep talking about the zero temperature limit. Like, I'm not going to talk about finite temperature, so focus on the zero temperature limit. Then you are going to see this kind of sudden, what is it? It, like Heaviside step function like distribution. But in case of Fermi surface, and in case of Fermi liquid, when the interaction is included, you can see some different behavior like this. This curve is because of the interaction between electrons. But still, it has some singularity to allow us to define some kind of Fermi surface, even though it is not very exact Fermi surface we may expect in the Fermi gas context, non-interacting system. In case of non-Fermi liquid, which when the interactions are very strong, the concept of Fermi surface is very intricate, and sometimes it is ill-defined. But here I will going to discuss only the case when the Fermi surface is well-defined. Like, I will forget about like very complicated case where the Fermi surface disappear all of a sudden. Not every non-Fermi liquid behave in this way, but there are some non-Fermi liquids such that the occupation number changes smoothly like this. But actually, it is not smooth at all. If you take the derivative on this this curve, you can find out that like there is a singularity at higher order derivative, and at that singular point we define the so-called critical Fermi surface. Like, so when I say the Fermi surface, this means the critical Fermi surface. Like, I will not gonna mention this kind of subtlety after this. Okay.
Can we use other quantity to detect the singularity of this curve, because we cannot just check at every point and find the singular derivative.
Well, up to now, I don't have any other way to define it. Yeah.
Well, this is the importance of finding like this exact mathematical definition of the Fermi surface, rather than just saying like I want a cutoff where I have like 95% of all my electrons.
Yes, kind of. Like, it is experimentally important because like people are still relying on the Fermi surface picture, even though they already know that there are very strong interactions when they measure something. Like, for instance, we can define the concept of bend when we deal with weakly interacting system, but when the interactions are strong enough, those bend picture is not very clear actually. But experimental physicists are keep using it. And sometimes they even show the bend diagram based on the experimental like redefinition. Like, I'm not sure how theoretically well defined the object, but they somehow define their own way. And because we have to work with all those people, like we are chip stick to this definition. Of course, it is very useful in theoretical sense as well, because there is singularity at the energy. Okay, would you please turn off the light? Thank you. So, let's consider the low-lying excitation of Fermi surface. So, in this Fermi surface, like this Fermi surface looks very circular, like very nice, pretty circle. But we can think of the wiggly fluctuation of the boundary. Like, this must be the low-lying excitation of the Fermi surface. Well, you can think of it as a particle hole excitation near the Fermi surface. And we can think of this thin shell, which kind of gives some bound for the fluctuation of this Fermi surface. And let's say this bound as a lambda f. And now consider how the gauge field interact with this Fermi surface. Like, it can couple with this point in this long radial direction, but this radial direction radial component cannot be large because it requires very large energy to excite. Actually, as you see, this yellow line gives some cutoff. So the length of the radial component would be this much short. But this is not the longest possible gauge component of the gauge field. Actually, the longest component would be this component. So it is still inside this shell, but it couples to this Fermi point with this large vector component. So what I want to emphasize here is not the radial part, but the transverse component of the gauge field is important. So that is why I, like previously, Lagrangian is written in terms of the transverse gauge field. The radial parts are all ignored by approximation. And this is the bound that the this is cut off for this component of the gauge field. So this is almost the maximum size of the gauge field. It can couple to the Fermi point at this point, because if this size is larger, then it will go out this boundary, right? So this length would be the cutoff lambda b. And see how the Fermi surface are coupled to each other via this gauge field. You can consider that like this point and this field are coupled to this gauge field, but it has this point can also couple with here and there with this thin shell with the size of lambda f. And you can think of this region, and this region can couple the gauge field through about this size from the width lambda f. So here I draw two different range of the gauge field component that can connect the Fermi points. And you can see this shaded region in the center. So because of this shaded region, actually, every Fermi point can be coupled through the gauge field, because this gauge field also share the point here. And well, sorry for my English. Like, let's go back to this interaction term. So if I write down this interaction term in the k space, like it will gonna say that a q times psi of j k times psi of j k plus q. And if there is an overlapping region for every possible direction, then it means every Fermi point will be effectively coupled. But what we can recognize is if this lambda f is very sufficiently small, this region, size of this region decreases as a square of lambda f. So if lambda f is very small, we can neglect this overlapping region. So fermions at different angle mean this point and that point are effectively decoupled at low energy limits. So we can think of this Fermi surface, we can just focus on the interaction between the gauge field and this particular Fermi point. So this becomes kind of local theory. But actually, it is too much exaggeration, because the Fermi vector here, this point can actually couple to the exactly opposite side, because here and here can be coupled by parallel or anti-parallel gauge field. So actually, we cannot treat this point 100% locally. Actually, we need two patches, like here and here. So And another issue is this size of lambda b is scaled as square root of lambda f times kf. But kf is determined by microscopic physics, so we cannot have a freedom to tune it. But in the low energy limit, lambda f will be smaller and smaller. So this lambda b over kf scales to zero. And when you calculate it, this angle theta parameterize the Fermi surface get the anomalous dimension, positive anomalous dimension. So theta was actually compactified to 0 to 2 pi, but because of the quantum correction, actually it is decompactified to minus infinity to infinity. But I will not, but intuitively, it is actually what we are seeing is as we lower our energy scale, the gauge field here, consider this point as pretty much flat space, not the curved space. So effectively, the gauge field here consider this point as a flat space. That is what this means. And now I want to approximate this region as a parabola. Like, we can always introduce harmonic approximation. And for simplicity, even though I say the minimal theory should be a two-path theory, which can be coupled through parallel and anti-parallel gauge field at both sides, I'll forget about that fact and focus only on the one-path here, because even one-path theory is complex enough. And Fermi surface here is, this is what Yan asked previously. So that intermediate term is provide the Fermi surface. And this is this red line is actually the Fermi surface of the system. So inside the parabola is filled state, and outside is the empty state. And we can write the quantum effective action, like you guys know how to derive this through like all those detail. Like, you learned the detail in QFT2, then I'm gonna show the result. So this is the kinetic term, and you get the electron self-energy one-loop correction here. And you get bosonic self-energy one-loop correction here. And what you have to, and this is the interaction term, and by the dimensional analysis, you can find out that these two terms are irrelevant operator. But you should be careful, because this term is irrelevant, but it is dangerously irrelevant, because if you get away this irrelevant operator, you cannot actually get this correction. Like, so even though this operator itself is irrelevant, it is K0. So it is dynamics of the fermion which generate all this quantum correction. So you have to actually deal with this operator. You should not take away this to properly understand the physics. So for fixed M, like, you can see that this is order of K0 to the 2^3 power, and this is linear order. And you can see that the quantum correction actually dominates the Baryer term at low energy. So quantum correction plays more important role than the Baryer term. This is a renormalizable effective theory. So based on the previous analysis of the relevant operator and irrelevant operator, actually there was no relevant operator, but everything was either marginal, irrelevant, or dangerously irrelevant. So we take away all those irrelevant operator and left all the marginal and irrelevant and dangerously irrelevant operator. And this is the term for the dangerously irrelevant operator, the dynamical term for the fermion. And when you deal with this Lagrangian, you have to take care about the limiting process. Like, sometimes it is very important to take care of which limit to take first and which limit to take next. And the low energy limit means the energy scale is always smaller than the cutoff, both bosonic cutoff and the fermionic cutoff. And at the same time, this is the one loop energy, order of one loop energy correction of the fermionic self-energy. And we expect to take this eta goes to zero first, and then take this cutoff go to the infinity, and then n goes to infinity. So what it means is, like, we want to make sure that we deal with the low energy limit first, and then take the large end limit, instead of going to the large end limit first and then go to the low energy limit. Like, if you change the order, the problem becomes too simple, actually. So, and there are five free parameters, like eta, vx, vy, e, and n. And there are five variables to rescale. And if we fix if we choose one scale to fix the dimension and fix the scale, then we have 4 degrees of freedom to absorb the 5 parameter. So we have freedom to absorb eta, dx, vi, and e into these variables, and which means there is no free parameter other than the number of flavor n. So why this is important? It is important because when we deal with the quantum field theory in high energy physics, like we usually use this coefficient e as a kind of flag for the perturbation expansion. But in this case, like we can always rescale e to e1 so that the electrons are always strongly interacting. So we cannot get away. We cannot actually use the perturbation expansion we usually use. So let's see the perturbative 1 over n expansion, because this is only problem that we can take care of. For example, let's consider the two-loop fraction of the interaction vertex. And naive estimate would give this. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5 vertices, and one fermion loop. One fermion loop would give n flavor, and 5 vertices would give n to the minus 5 hop. And eventually, it seems like higher order loops are suppressed in large n. But actually, it is not true. Why? Because the Dress fermion propagator, this line, are not order 1. It is actually, it gives actual extra factor of n here. Like you can see that if you calculate the self-energy of the fermion propagator, you get the order n when fermions are all on Fermi surface. So you cannot naively expect that the high order loops are suppressed in large n. Then what would gonna happen? So let's introduce something called singular manifold. This expression is the quantum effective action for under the condition that every particles are on the Fermi surface. And if we calculate all the integrals, we get this is function of this. This is regular part. And you can see that it has some divergent part when we let eta goes to 0. So there is a 1 over eta singularity. But this calculation is based on the bare propagator of fermion. So if we introduce the Dress fermion propagator to calculate the effective action, then we get, instead of 1 over eta, we get the enhancement factor n. The reason can be interpreted in this particular way. So this is the n-dimensional. Well, let's think about, I'm going to keep use this example, like even though I didn't show the figure many times. In this particular example, like there are like actually 2 loops, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4 fermion propagators and 2 photon propagator. And among the 4 photon propagator, actually there not every momentum. Okay, so we can think of, like, if you think about the Fermi surface, there is some translation in Fermi surface that does not require energy at all. So let's consider there is a bump in the Fermi surface. And if we rotate this bump along the Fermi surface, it does not require any energy. So there is a 1 degree of freedom that does not require any cost of energy. So here I write down this direction as a q, which means only three integral can deal with the IR divergence from the propagator. And because of that, we get extra order n enhancement factor. This might not be very clear, so let me introduce some more intuitive picture. So we can think about scattering your Fermi surface. So consider the scattering from this point to this point through the gauge field. And we can label these two different Fermi points by the angle theta and theta prime. And we can interpret the momentum transfer by gauge field by the difference of the k theta and k theta prime. And when two electrons are on the Fermi surface, we can uniquely determine this expression. And so from this idea, we can express the Feynman diagram in the double line representation. So this is the previous vertex correction. And you can see that like these lines of the momentums are fixed by external condition, but the internal loop has a degrees of freedom. So you can, like, no matter what kind of momentum flow here, it will automatically satisfy that every fermions are on the Fermi surface. So this extra degrees of freedom actually is equivalent to the dimension of the singular manifold, and this gives a one order of the enhancement factor n. So because of that, the theory, all planar diagrams, actually I didn't show it right now, but all planar diagrams are eventually equivalent. So because of the enhancement factor, actually the higher loop diagrams are not suppressed and actually show same order to the low, like every loop diagram have the same order of 1 over n. So all planar diagrams are important. And so even though we only have 1 over n to control the theory, this expansion cannot control the theory. So we need new systematic and controlled approximation. And in addition, I said there is only one free parameter n, which means like in case of SUN gauge theory, we can connect this theory to the string theory in large n, but this strategy doesn't really help us. So like in usual large N expansion, we have extra parameter so-called top coupling, but here we don't have top coupling. Actually, we can consider it as a top coupling with order one. So dual string theory in higher dimension, like 3+1 dimension, is also strongly interacting. So like ADS CFT strategy doesn't help us. So how to deal with this issue was proposed by a few people, and one of the solutions was proposed by Dennis Tarlovich, and it is using the dimensional regularization, and by controlling theory using the dimension of the co-dimension of the Fermi surface, like he discussed about the perturbative calculation of the critical exponent of the non-Fermi liquid, and this is all my presentation. Any question?
Just to be clear, n is the number of electrons in your system, or
number of what? And, oh, yeah. Okay, sorry, I didn't mention it. N is actually number of flavor of the particle, and in truth, n is one, right?
Yeah.
We only have electron, like we don't have like muon or tauon, like inside our metal. But sometimes people, like because electron occupied it at different type of orbital behave differently. So sometimes people treat p orbital electron and d orbital electron differently. So some people say it is different flavor in some sense. But still, it is still n equal two, right? So and never be large actually, but because people didn't have any good strategy to solve this problem, many people actually naively expect that large n somehow cure this problem without detailed calculation. So the main message of this work is all those naive expectation is not really true, and ADS CFT cannot cure the problem. So you have to find some other way. And that is the conclusion of this whole work, actually. No solution was provided.
Because this isn't like a easily, there's not like an easy setup you can do an experiment which gives you this, right?
Because yes, right.
So you can't really have an experimental setup.
Yeah, right. Like there is no large end realization in our universe. So. Okay. No question? Thank you.
Hi.
Hi guys, today I'm going to talk about my MSc work, which I began sort of like somewhere in the first half of last year and pretty much put on hold when coming to PI, and I finished it a couple of weeks ago, so I'm excited to give a talk about it for the first time. I'm definitely going to run over time. It's called Exact Global Symmetry Generators for Restricted Schur Polynomials. First, I'm going to just give one slight justification of why a group representation theory approach to some problems in N equals 4 super Young-Mills theory is justified. I don't understand a lot of the background to N equals 4 super Young-Mills theory, so it's very brief. Then the biggest bit will be the background, some of the concepts we need in order to understand the approach that we use, like concepts like Schur polynomials and the projectors that we were concerned with, et cetera. And then we'll get onto the actual novel results of my dissertation, which I'll talk about when considering the SU2 sector. And the main novel results I'll talk about then, the obviously analytical results. And then finally, only in the conclusion or next steps does the actual physics come in. Right. N equals 4 super Young-Mills theory from the get-go is a theory of conformal symmetry. So it's, from the beginning, not very realistic, but it's often a proving ground for more complicated and realistic theories. And that's why people, I guess, bother studying it. There are a lot of fields in N equals 4 super Young-Mills theory. There's gauge fields and fermionic fields, but we, for my MSc, just concerned ourselves with the six scalar fields, which we call phi. The theory itself enjoys global SO6 symmetry. However, if you consider that whole group, then or the whole algebra, then you would have to necessarily also consider the fermions and the gauge fields, because under the action of that group, bosons or the scalar fields would get rotated into some of the gauge fields, etc. So we rather just consider the SU2 subgroup, which under that subgroup, we just concerned ourselves and we just had to study the six scalar fields, which we combined in these three combinations. For the SU2 sector, we have considered two of the fields, the two of the complex bosonic fields, Z and Y. And the work that I'm going to talk about when I can talk about the SU2 sector, we did sort of the same thing in the SU3 sector, in which case we'd have to consider X also. All right. Now, of course, N equals 4 super Young-Mills theory is a theory of conformal symmetry. A lot of the effort goes into calculating the combinatoric factors which you get in correlation functions, which involve a sum over all weak contractions. However, the benefit of using a group representation theory approach is that a lot of the multi-trace operators which appear in the correlation functions can be recast in terms of Schur polynomials and restricted Schur polynomials, which I'll get to now. And in that case, the combinatoric factors become sums over elements belonging to certain symmetric groups. Right. To sum in the background, we didn't.
I might just get lost because of my absence. What is GRT?
Group representation theory, sorry.
Oh.
Yes, group representation theory. Okay. We denote by Sn the symmetric group. It's the group of all permutations of elements 1 to n, or at least n distinct elements. And a nice result from group representation theory is that for a symmetric group, there are a finite number of inequivalent irreducible representations of Sn. We call these inequivalent irreducible representations will be denoted by Young diagrams with n blocks, diagrams that look similar to a few of these guys that I've drawn on the board here. I denoted these Young diagrams or the specific representations with uppercase Latin indices. And so under the representation R, sigma, which is an element of this arbitrary Sn group, becomes this matrix, gamma R sigma, and the trace of that we've called chi. This is the character of the element sigma in the R representation, and tables of those characters exist in different references.
Is the gamma matrices the one same as the satisfying Dirac algebra ones, or are you just using some, that's just a name?
No, it's just a name.
Okay,
just right. Okay, I'll talk about it a bit later, but there's also ways of restricting Sn. For example, if S4, if you consider the S2 by S2 subgroup, we can restrict it and consider different subgroups depending on the restriction. And if we restrict Sn in a certain way, then an irreducible representation often becomes reducible, and more often than not becomes the direct sum of smaller irreducible representations. Now, because we can consider these subgroups under such a restriction, it makes sense that we can project onto one of these subspaces. I'll talk about this V-tensor now. We can project onto some of the subspaces. And indeed, we can. This is the definition of the projector that we use. This is just in the one field case. So I'm just talking about if we just consider Z now. Later on, I'll talk about if we consider Z and Y. This is the definition of the projector. We sum over all symmetric group elements with the character and then sigma acting on Vn. Now, the benefit of all of this is that we can write any multi-matrix operator, which appears in the correlation functions in N equals 4 super Young-Mills theory. We can write a lot of these multi-matrix operators, this right-hand side here, which is constructed from the fields Z. And these z's act on the vector space V, and it's not doesn't matter what V n is at the moment. Yeah.
So the sigma is sort of a fundamental representation.
Sorry. Sigma is just like a two cycle or three cycle in S n, and gamma r sigma is a representation of sigma in the Rth representation.
But then you take the sum of all these sigmas, right?
Yes. It depends on what you're acting on. Sometimes this could be gamma or sigma. Sometimes it's sigma, sometimes it's gamma or sigma. It depends on what you're acting on, yeah?
What are these indices?
The indices and indices, I'll get to that now. But anyway, the benefit of all of this is that we can write a multi-matrix operator, these guys which appear in the correlation functions, within a single framework as a single matrix operator, this guy acting on a much larger Hilbert space. So by if we just choose sigma in a clever way, we can encompass a lot of the different multi-matrix operators which appear in the correlation function. I don't know. I wrote you on the board. I don't know if someone wants to put the light on, and I can talk a little bit about what I mean. If we consider, let's say we're considering S4. So N is 4. So there's, here N would be 4. And then we're necessarily considering S4. If we take an arbitrary, let's say a two cycle in S4, say 1, 2, the trace of sigma 1, 2, which acts on these Z4s, gives this product of all the Zs. Sigma 1 is the integer that 1 gets permuted to under the action of sigma. And in this case, it would be Zi1, I2, Zi2, I1, which gives me the trace of Z squared. And Zi3, I3, Zi4, I4 gives me the trace of Z squared. Another result, which I think I talked about on the next thing, Skunk. All permutations which belong to the same conjugacy class give rise to the same observables. And elements are part of the same conjugacy class if they have the same cycle structure. So all two cycles, all three cycles, all products of, if you have two cycles, those guys give rise to the same observable here on the right hand side. So I didn't have to talk about 1, 2, I could talk about 1, 3, 1, 4, 2, 4, whatever. All right, now using this definition of the projector, we define these super important things called Schur polynomials, which also denote by chi, but its argument is the field Z. It is a linear combination of, we have characters. It's a linear combination of these single matrix operators acting on the larger space. It's worth noting that it's possible to kind of find the Fourier transform of this equation and express the single matrix operator in terms of a sum of restricted Schur polynomials. Schur polynomials. These Schur polynomials are important because you can write these multi-matrix or these single matrix operators in terms of Schur polynomials, right? And then just talk about how all of this actually relates, I guess, to physics. The two-point correlation function in this simple zero-dimensional single matrix model, zero-dimensional because the field Z doesn't depend on space-time points in this model, and single matrix because I'm just considering Zs now, I don't have Ys yet. gives us this result here, the delta, we know what it means. If R is the product of the factors of the blocks in a certain representation. So again, yeah, it doesn't matter if you can see it, but given some R diagram, the factor of a box is capital N the size of a matrix plus the content of that box. And the content is just the column number plus the row number. So if you look, maybe, I don't know if the lights go on later, you'll see it's just the product of all these numbers in these boxes. And this is exact. This is not, no approximations in this guy. All right, if we now move over to the two-field case where we have, where we concern things going off, where we also consider Y, two bosonic field case, and sigma being an element of Sn plus m, the generalization of this, or I guess the result that's analogous to this guy in the two field case, assumes this form. And from it, this represents a specific observable in n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory. And sometimes I know now in this talk I've been talking about them as if I've been calling the fields bosonic fields. They're bosonic because we can see if we swap the z's amongst themselves and the y's amongst themselves, the results don't change. If we kind of like freeze the indices and just swap z's and y's, the results don't change. Well, the operator that you get doesn't change. But if we swap the z's and y's amongst, if we swap a z with a y, we would get a different result. And that's where this restriction comes in. In this two-field case, we don't consider elements being, like I said earlier, permutations which are in the same conjugacy class give rise to the same observables. In the two-field case, we need to talk about restricted conjugacy classes. Where I mentioned earlier in the single-field case, elements with the same cycle structure give rise to the same observable. Here, elements which belong to the same restricted conjugacy class give rise to the same observable. But and in this definition here, if sigma and tau are related in this way, with rho being an element of Sn plus m, that would have been the case in the single field case. But here, we need to restrict rho to being an element of Sn times Sm. And if that's the case, rho is an element of Sn times Sm, not in general an element of the full symmetric group, then sigma and tau give rise to the same observables. And it's because of this restriction why I say restricted in a lot of what follows. All right, yeah. Upon restriction of this irreducible representation of Sn plus m, it, like I said, it'll decompose into a number of irreducible representations themselves. Okay, we need now decompose into a number of irreducible representations of Sn by Sm. So now because we have these two symmetric groups kind of side by side, we need two Young diagrams to label a representation of Sn by Sm. We need a Young diagram R, which is a partition of n. This just means that the diagram R is made up of n blocks. We need the one small diagram R, which labels the Sn bits, and a diagram S, which labels the Sm bits. This is not in general the case. In general, you also need a multiplicity label, because when you do this decomposition, you can get a lot of copies of R times S. But I'll explain later when we only consider the case with Young diagrams having two rows. And if there are only two rows, then you don't have any need for the multiplicity labels. Yes, and using these RS labels, we define these things, which is just the most difficult thing to calculate. They're called restricted characters. This I here is just a state in the RS carrier space. And yeah, this is the definition of a restricted character. There's no tables of it that exist like in the single field case. And yeah, this is often the guy that's tough to work out. All right. But once we have these restricted characters, we can use them to define restricted Schur polynomials, similar to what I did here. I have a Schur polynomial, and also had a projector back here. I can use this restricted character to define a restricted Schur polynomial in the two-field case. Right? Again, a linear combination of single trace operators, but now having a restricted character in their definition.
And we can also use the restricted characters to define appropriate projectors. Right, and again, just how this relates to the physics, I remember reading a paper where the calculation of the two-point function in this case, yeah?
Project problem, like I don't remember.
Hmm?
Like, well, this is projector project problem.
That's fine. And I hardly concerned myself with what V intensity is, because we're more worried about the projectors than the actual space they
just on some space.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not too worried about what just it's the projectors that are important. We can define these restricted Schur polynomials and we can define these projectors. And as I was saying, I remember reading the derivation of this. It takes, I think, like 3 pages. But then this is how this connects to the physics, the two-point correlation function with restricted Schur polynomials constructed from 2 complex bosonic fields. Is this formula FR, again, is the product of the factors of the boxes. And I think for those of you guys who did the standard model, I think did talk about the Hooke lengths of Young diagram boxes. It's just the number of boxes to the right of a box plus the number of boxes below plus 1 for the box itself. So it's just all integers times by one another. So this is not difficult to work out. All right, I think that's the background. I'm getting into what we actually did. For now, we actually did consider the SU3 sector also, but the SU2 sector was a little bit simpler, so we considered it at first. We first wanted to find the action of the 3 SU2 generators on these restricted Schur polynomials, which were made from the complex field Z and Y. In this case, this is the form that the generators assume. It turns out that we only need to calculate the action, and this is what a lot of the work was, is finding the action of these generators on restricted Schur polynomials. But it turns out we're actually really cool. We only needed to find one of them because J minus and J plus are related via Hermitian conjugation, and the action of J3 is very trivial. So not difficult calculation, but we found that the action of J minus acting on the restricted Schur polynomial assumes this. Looks quite ugly, but it's not so bad, this form here. These DTs are, again, just numbers based on factorials and Hooke lengths and whatever. This is the guy that we found analytical results for. I'd say the finding formula for these guys was the main result. In this formula here, as I mentioned, R is a Young diagram made up of n plus m blocks. R is got made up of n blocks. S is made up of m blocks. But T plus is made up of N plus 1 blocks, and U minus is made up of M minus 1 blocks. So the action of J minus acting on this restricted Schur polynomial is a sum of other restricted Schur polynomials, but with a block taken away from S to form U minus, and a block added to R to form T plus. All right? So the action of J minus is to remove a box from R, and or add a box to R and remove a box from S. And this summation here runs over diagrams where T plus subduces R. What I basically mean by that, if you're given a T plus, you can take one block away from it to be left with R, and where S subduces U minus. So given S, taking a block away from S leaves us with U minus. We only considered, like I mentioned, the case where every diagram has at maximum 2 rows. I'm told that this is due to a system with 2 giant gravitons. Somehow, I don't really know how. But if the diagrams themselves only have 2 rows, then this summation here will have at most 4 terms. Because if I give you R, you can add a block to either the first or second row. And if I give you S, you can take away a block from either the first or second row. So then it leaves 4 combinations. And so then the tough bit was calculating formula for these traces depending on where blocks are removed or added to. I've drawn some diagrams here on the board, but I think you guys know what Young diagrams look like, right? Okay, then I wrote a bit too much here. We normalized the restricted Schur polynomial based on what the two-point function was. So this is now just a normalized version of the restricted Schur polynomial. Again, this formula looks quite ugly, but these are all this is the easy bit. This bit here is not difficult to calculate. It's these traces which were the problem, and I mentioned that already. All right, so here I'm getting onto the actual novel results, which I think I'm already running over time, so I don't know how much time I'm going to have to talk about it. As I said, we consider the two-row case. In previous papers, this work had been done, but they used something called the displaced corners approximation, so that where the first row of a Young diagram is much longer than the second row. And then the results are a lot easier to compute. And they moved over to these variables, which I'll talk to now, because then the problem just becomes calculating SU2, Clebsch, Gordon coefficients. And I think there are computers that can do that quite easily. But first of all, instead of considering RI, RI, and SI, which is just the row lengths of these different diagrams, we rather used this translation here to move to labeling all of the restricted Chow polynomials with these five numbers. As I said, it's easier because then in the approximation case, the problem becomes just calculating Clebsch Gordon coefficients. All right, I'm not going to have too much time to talk about these actual results here, but I'll talk about quickly how we derive these trace guys. If we define indices with these ranges, so I and j run from 1 all the way up to m plus n, alpha and beta just run from m plus 1 to m plus n, so that's alpha and beta is kind of like the Sn bit, and a and b run from 1 to m. In order to calculate those traces, the four-trace formula we're looking for, we need this restricted character where one of the variables belongs to, can assume this range, and the other variable can assume this range. So calculating this restricted character was part of the work. And we went about this by using Casimirs. Talk a little bit about that later. But if we use this notation here, we take this here being a two cycle, so one of the group elements, a two cycle. If we use this notation here to mean the sum over all distinct two cycles over the index range, so for example, yeah, the sum over all ij, ij, would just be the sum over all distinct two cycles with the indices running over this range. So 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, da 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 da, 3, 4, 3, 5, all of the different two cycles in this range. We can see that the sum over all two cycles within this range is the sum over all distinct two cycles with indices in this range, plus the sum of all distinct two cycles with indices in this range, plus the sum of all distinct two cycles with one index in this range and another index in this range. So writing that down and just jumbling the formula about, we are left with this left-hand side, which is related to what we're looking for. All right. And then the derivation of this took a while, but I'm just going to kind of give a hand-wavy argument. If we take this formula here, apply a projector on both sides, so P, R, 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 S, and then take the trace of the results. The left-hand side here, this is what we want. And the right-hand side, you can calculate because the sum over all distinct two cycles turns out to be a Casimir with the eigenvalue equal to the number of row pairs in a diagram minus the number of column pairs. So I don't know if you guys can see this too well, but like the number of row pairs in this diagram would be like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and the number of column pairs would just be 1, 2, 3. All right, so then that's kind of like the coefficient, the eigenvalue. And then if you take the projector, and these guys are different because in this case, the indices run over A and B, and with A and B being from 1 to M, so you consider the S diagram in this case. This here, alpha and beta running over m plus 1 to m plus n, and that corresponds to the R diagram. And I and J corresponds to the big R diagram. So you just look at different diagrams and count the number of rows, count the number of columns in general. And then using this translation, taking this formula, taking the projector on, acting the projector on both sides, and then taking the trace, the left-hand side is equal to this. And then the right-hand side, if done generally, gives this. It's actually quite a nice, not a horrible looking expression. And so that's how we got the first equality. And the second equality results from the fact that all characters which belong to the same conjugacy class are actually equal, even in this restricted case. So this is just a generic character with one element, with one value belonging to the R diagram bit, with one index belonging to the S diagram bit. And A runs over, I think, 1 to M. So that's where we get m from, and then alpha can assume indistinct failures, and because all those characters are equal, this is how we get this result.
Okay.
And now,
why are we interested in sampling?
Because you need this if you want to work out those traces.
Okay.
And I'm not going to have too much time because I see I've already run over time.
No, you should conclude.
I'll conclude soon. Yeah. Okay, but yeah, this is kind of the hand-wavy argument. Some of the traces, depending on the forms of the diagrams, are very easy to calculate. I've got the proofs at the end of this presentation if anyone wants to know how we did it. But we derived a number of formula based on sums of traces, and some of them were very simple to calculate themselves, depending on what you're projecting onto. And then a miracle happens, and we end up with this ugly-looking formula for one of the traces. This is the same as those traces here, just written in terms of my new variables, R1, JJ, 3, and M. So this is just one of the formulae we calculated. And the other three, we found similar results, so I just didn't want to put them all in because it takes up a lot of space. Now, with these guys, we can take these exact, all of this is exact. We can take these trace results, go back to our action for J minus, plug it in here, and simplify all of these ugly looking things, and end up with even uglier looking but exact expressions. This is the action of J minus acting on a normalized restricted Schur polynomial. See, it's again the sum of four terms. And the big bit to calculate was A minus, B minus, C minus, and D minus. This is what A minus looked like, and it looks very similar looking formula for B minus, C minus, D minus. And these Schur polynomials are just related to this restricted Schur polynomial in like this one here. If we take this restricted Schur polynomial and we add a block to the first row of small r, and you take away a block from the second row of S, that corresponds with this restricted Schur polynomial, whereas this one, these two here, will add a block to the second row of R. Yeah, so it's just moving blocks about. And then, yeah, this was the main result, calculating these A minus B, C, and D guys. And this is, again, just has to do with the issue two case. Right? And I'll talk about the conclusion. This was not even half of what we did. We did sort of the, not exactly the same, but we also considered the SU3 case. In that case, there are actually eight trace formulae. So it's not just four terms, it's actually the sum of eight terms. And what was nice is we could actually use some of the issue two results, but not exclusively, right? And so I remember when I told Martijn about this, he said, like, where's the physics? And yeah, I guess there's not much physics, but you can use this to work out a lot of the physics. D here is the dilatation operator. So with us having found J minus exactly, and because we found J minus exactly, you can find J plus exactly by taking the Hermitian conjugate of J minus, and the action of J3 is trivial. So having found all the generators of SU2 exactly, we only need to consider this one relation, but by using this symmetry condition, I guess using this condition, it's actually possible to calculate the dilatation operator in n equals 4 super Young Moseley, but only up to an arbitrary multiplicative constant. We don't believe that we can determine it exactly, but so up to some constant in front, you can actually, imposing this, you can actually determine the dilatation operator. When you do that, you end up with horrible looking recursion relations. I mean, this is already ugly enough. Now, imposing this, you end up with a long list of recursion relations. And what I think was done in a previous case, but in this approximation, this distant corners approximation, what they did is they took a continuum limit of, I think, a large n limit of the result. And then all the recursion relations resulting from this condition become a set of partial differential equations. And if you solve those simultaneously, you get the matrix elements for the dilatation operator. And yes, in the SU3, we did the same thing for the SU3 case, except there are eight generators. And again, the expressions were even uglier than this. But yeah, all of these results were exact. Like if you took the distant corners approximation, this square root here would just boil down to just being the square root of R1. And this whole term here would disappear. So the results look a lot nicer in the distant corners approximation. Okay, so you can consider, we did in my dissertation consider the SU3 case. And yes, the dilatation operator is important. I think it's related to the Hamiltonian in N equals 4 super Young-Mills theory, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, that's where the physics comes in. Thank you.
Here the result is true only for tree level, or it works for any case? Because
you mean like these results here?
The dilatation operator.
The dilatation operator results were valid up to. It depends on what you use as your definition of the dilatation operator. The dilatation operator, when acting on these restricted Schur polynomials, doesn't move blocks around within different diagrams, but it moves blocks around within the diagrams themselves. So like J minus takes away an S block and adds it to R, the dilatation operator would just shuffle around blocks within the diagrams themselves. So when it acts on R, it might take one block and put it at the bottom. It might take this S block and put it at the bottom, or it might take this block and put it at the top. And it depends on, in this paper, they just went up to one loop. But it depends up to what order you want to do. If you do it up to one loop order, then you could just consider the dilatation operator shifting one block around. If you want to do it up to second loop order, then you would consider the dilatation operator up to moving two blocks around. But I think to one loop, the dilatation operator has 9 terms, and up to two loops, it has 27 terms, and then it just goes on and on and on. But in this paper, it was just up to first order. And I'm talking about it, it's in this paper here where they considered the dilatation operator more.
One thing I also confused is, so for this Schur's polynomials, all these operators within this Schur's polynomial, my same polynomial has same dimensions, or?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. So, but then the dilatation operator just makes the Schur's polynomials. But how can you sort of like restrict this Schur's polynomial to just specific operators? You just look at the code.
I'm not sure I know what you mean. What do you mean? How can you?
I get it.
I'll speak to you now if you want. Cool. Talk's done.